Sherman
and Maya Schoen, coming to you Tuesday, November 11th, 2003. A forward strategy of freedom. That is what President Bush called U.S. policy when he spoke before the National Endowment for Democracy on November 6th. A forward strategy of freedom is the new U.S. policy in the Middle East. Stability cannot be purchased at the expense of liberty, President Bush said. The advance of freedom is the calling of our time, is the calling of our country. He referred to Woodrow Wilson and the 14 points, Franklin Delano Roosevelt and the four freedoms, and particularly his speech was closely analogous to Ronald Reagan's 1982 speech at Westminster when he called for the fall of the Soviet Union. Invasion, occupation, remaking the world, that is really at the root of the forward strategy of freedom in the Middle East. As Bush said, the failure of Iraqi democracy would embolden terrorists around the world, increase dangers to the American people, and extinguish the hopes of millions in the region. But what was he really talking about? He says it specifically. Successful societies privatize their economies, secure the rights of property. Property, privatization, government as the cash cow for the capitalist ruling class. Today on Taking Aim, when we examine the forward strategy of freedom on Veterans Day, we're going to look at the reality on the ground in Iraq and the impact on the U.S. soldiers. Ralph?
It is a forward strategy that was well articulated by the former Central Intelligence Agency director of Bill Clinton, James Woolsey, with his call for World War IV. It has been articulated by the entire panoply of strategists and cohorts of W when they have outlined the necessity to replace each successor regime in the Arab East. And it's a bit ironic, of course, as we're well aware, all of us who have followed the policies of U.S. imperialism over the many years and decades, that there is not a single regime in place in any part of the world where United States rulers aspire to control the resources and the cheap labor, not a single regime of a dictatorial character that the U.S. has not sustained, initiated, and kept into place by force of arms. And indeed, every struggle of resistance on the part of the oppressed has been responded to by invasion and by putsch and by Central Intelligence Agency counterinsurgency. From Saddam Hussein, their man in Baghdad for 27 years, to the Shah of Iran, to the feudal elites that are scattered across the Gulf and Saudi Arabia, the royal feudal elites, the monarchy itself, the 200-person feudal family of the Asaba clan in Kuwait with its $2.8 trillion in U.S. and European banks, all installed, maintained, armed, and preserved by U.S. capital. And now we have an era of this period, an era rather of this power structure where it is no longer feasible for them to maintain these comprador regimes, but they want to rule direct. Seizing Arab oil, the new El Dorado awaiting its conquistador, is the way the Pentagon and the intelligence agencies and their think tanks outline their strategy throughout the 60s and the 70s. Bush articulates now the forward policy of displacing each successive regime that they themselves had installed in the service of a decaying capital that can no longer even afford the comprador rulers and their cut.
A forward strategy of freedom in Iraq. But what does it really mean? Milt Bearden, a 30-year CIA veteran, director of operations, the senior manager for clandestine operations in Afghanistan, stated specifically in the New York Times, November 9th, Iraqi insurgents take a page from the Afghan freedom fighters. My own experience in war, he wrote, has been largely on the side of insurgents. I served as the Central Intelligence Agency's quartermaster and political agent to the Afghan resistance, so-called resistance, against the Soviet occupation from 1986 until the Soviets left in 1989. In fact, Dearden was the CIA station chief in Pakistan and the station commander running the Mujahideen. From his perspective, he writes, the Iraqi resistance has taken a page from a sophisticated insurgency playbook in their confrontations with the American-led coalition. And what is that strategy? That is the strategy of Sun Tzu. Does this remind you of something? The American military strategy for the massive bombardment of Iraq, the original devastation, the JDAMs, the horror show bombing Iraq, was crafted by the military people at the military college based upon Sun Tzu, the famous, renowned, ancient Chinese military tactician who wrote more than 2,500 years ago The Art of War, which is considered the highest realization of warfare, according to Dearden. And he said that, according to Sun Tzu, what the Iraqi insurgents are doing, what the Iraqi resistance is doing, is to attack the enemy's strategy.
2 points about this, Maya. Let's be clear. Milt Dearden, in his capacity as the director of operations and plans for the Central Intelligence Agency in Afghanistan, the setting up of the terror groups for the drawing in of the Soviet Union in Afghanistan, and then the attacks upon the Soviet troops themselves and the destabilization of the Central Asian republics, all of this operation of Dearden and the Central Intelligence Agency was what created al-Qaeda. They funded Osama bin Laden. They funded Hekmet Gulbadin with $30 billion. They established the Taliban through the instrument of the ISI in Pakistan, with just General Gul Hamid has laid out so clearly, the former director of the ISI. And what is...
And Ralph, also, they were following the Brzezinski strategy of drawing the Soviet Union into a Vietnam-type situation.
As outlined in the Grand Chessboard by Zbigniew Brzezinski, Carter's national security advisor, and let us emphasize that this operation of Milt Dearden was under the Democrats' watch, no less than it is now under that of the Bush administration itself. But here's how Dearden describes the current situation in Iraq, and it's important to take note of this. The Iraqi resistance shows skill beyond a mere band of thugs. And in quoting Sun Tzu, he makes the point to misread these operations as attacks of desperation is dangerous. These are multiple attacks, and those on the coalition headquarters with mortars and rockets landed inside a secure green zone. Ordinary criminals and thugs cannot deliver this kind of punch. Mortar tubes, base plates, ammunition have to be smuggled up to a few thousand yards of the green zone and carefully set up, and then launched in a shoot-and-scoot attack with time delays. Indeed, Deputy Defense Secretary Wolfowitz was but one room away, and this required imagination, ability, and training. Diehards, perhaps, but they are focused with strategy and the skills to carry it out. And Dearden is very honest in describing the growing attacks as having two clear goals, not just to inflict casualties, but to create the reaction from the occupier that will alienate the local population. And Dearden states both are being achieved. Both are being accomplished. And this is reflected in an incident described in the New York Times, he continues, about a group of U.S. soldiers who tossed handfuls of candy to Iraqi children along a road in Fallujah. And the children screamed, "Don't touch it, don't touch it, it's poison from the Americans, it will kill you." And Dearden relates that indeed there is a basis for this, because the U.S. has disseminated toxins and agents of contamination throughout the village areas of Iraq. Not just booby-trapped toys, not just poisoned wells, not just adulterated food, but the instruments of mass destruction across that country in an attempt to decimate and to occupy.
What he also says, Ralph, is that this is the very strategy that the CIA used in Afghanistan to have the Afghani people believe that anything that Soviets were doing was going to be poisoning the children and poisoning. So what he's saying now is that this is the CIA strategy. CIA understands it. What he also goes into, and I made a 5 points of from his article, from the Sun Tzu theory of attack the alliances, and one, that the insurgents, the Iraqi resistance, he calls them insurgents, the resistance detonated a car bomb outside the Jordanian embassy in Baghdad on August 7th, which killed 11 and wounded scores in order to attack Jordan. This was the assumption, he says, that the Jordanians were being too helpful to the U.S. Less than 3 weeks later, he notes, there was the attack on the United Nations. And then, in mid-October, he looks at Turkey, where Turkey had been intended to be sending in large numbers of troops to supplement the U.S. soldiers. And again, there was a bomb detonated outside the Turkish chancery in Baghdad. In late October, Baghdad also was under attack with the headquarters of the ICRC, the International Committee of the Red Cross, again like the United Nations, providing the so-called non-governmental aid. And then he refers to the attacks on anyone who collaborates with the U.S. forces, that is, members of the Iraqi Governing Council, figures in the judiciary, and the police recruits. And this, he says, is part of Sun Tzu's attack all alliances. Ralph?
It's interesting to note, Maya, that Irdin, who once again is a 30-year veteran and the CIA's director of operations and the senior manager for the Central Intelligence Agency of clandestine operations, he states that in Afghanistan, when they were funding al-Qaeda or what became al-Qaeda, quote, all the stories about the poisoning of wells and the poisoning of food were false, propagated by the CIA. The important thing is that we got people to believe them. And then he says, there are two stark lessons in the history of the 20th century. No nation that launches a war against another sovereign nation has ever won. Every nationalist-based insurgency against foreign occupation will ultimately succeed. Now, what is the head of clandestine operations voicing in the New York Times the thesis that oppressed people and those whose sovereignty is violated cannot be ultimately defeated? It echoes, Maya, a further piece by that apologist for U.S. occupation who had orchestrated in the press the necessity to fragment former Yugoslavia, David Reif, in an article echoing the words of Weirden called Blueprint for a Mess, in which Reif talks about how in the streets of Baghdad today, the Americans are not welcome. United States military personnel in the city are hunkered down behind acres of fencing and razor wire inside what was once Saddam Hussein's Republican Palace. When Paul Bremer III leaves the compound, he is surrounded by bodyguards, carbines at the ready, GIs on patrol in city streets that never let their hands stray far from their machine gun triggers and their M16s. And he says there is an average of 35 attacks each day on U.S. forces by armed resistors of one kind or another, and American commanders concede they operate with greater and greater support and sophistication. These voices in the established media reflect the fact that a major sector of the rulers are now coming to realize that the strategy in which they acquiesce with that wing of the class that seeks direct occupation and impermanent war, that it is blowing up in their faces, that they are damned if they do, and they are damned if they don't. And what they are doing now is not just losing the population of Iraq and in the Arab East as well, but losing the population in the United States in the process.
Ralph, in researching for this program, I discovered a 1998 CBS News story in which Bearden was interviewed. And at that time, he made the statement that if the United States was to were to invade Iraq, it would have to prepare itself for a very long occupation. And in another story, a story about U.S. soldiers that appeared in the Wall Street Journal and we'll discuss later on in the program, a story about the tent hospitals that appeared October 29th, there is a startling statement by Lieutenant Colonel Kim Kesslung, who's an orthopedic surgeon. And she was discussing the resistance and what was happening to the U.S. soldiers and all the amputations that she was having to conduct. She said, quote, "It is a mistake to discount the Iraq resistance. If someone invaded Texas, where she is from, we'd do the same thing." This is Lieutenant Colonel Kim Kesslung. Russ?
Well, it's interesting, Maya, that the blueprint for a mess thesis of Reef, which is echoing that of the point man in all of this, namely the Milton Bearden piece for the Central Intelligence Agency operatives who are saying to the current policymakers, Bush Sr. had it right. You need Saddam Hussein. You need his army. You need that repressive apparatus to facilitate imperial needs. And what Reif does is to describe how the stratagems of the State Department have been essentially overruled by Cheney and Rumsfeld and Pearl and Wolfowitz and Bremer and Garner and the like. Bremer, quote, took the opposite approach. He announced the complete disbanding of the Iraqi army, some 400,000 strong, and the lustration of 50,000 members of the party, of the Ba'ath Party. As one U.S. official remarked to me privately, that was the week we made 450,000 enemies on the ground in Iraq, a decision which was made not by Bremer, but the White House, and it was disastrous, Reif states. In a country like Iraq, where the average family size is six, firing 450,000 people amounts to leaving 2,700,000 people without income. In other words, more than 10% of Iraq's 23 million people. The order produced such bad feeling on the streets of Baghdad that salaries had to be reinstated for soldiers. And he goes on to detail how it is not just the population at large. It is the liquidation of the forces of repression so long funded by the United States on behalf of Saddam Hussein that has opened the door for a generalized resistance in Iraq, including the soldiers once in the uniforms of Saddam Hussein.
As you say, Ralph, it was a dismantling of the entire infrastructure in Iraq because during the years of sanction, it was the Iraqi government that had provided the entire food distribution network. And as the United Nations admitted, it was an efficient distribution network with local corner centers for the distribution of food. What the United States did was to destroy even the most basic food and health systems in Iraq, as well as the fact that there were so many people who had been on the public payroll. It was the Defense Department, sectors of the Defense Department, including Jay Garner, who had wanted to maintain the military apparatus. But as you said, it was other divisions of the U.S. government that, under L. Paul Bremer, took control and dismantled it, leaving the United States without the enforcement arm of the Iraqis to control the population.
Well, keep in mind, Maya, that the Central Intelligence Agency and the State Department intelligence and Bush Sr. and his Schwarzkopf and Colin Powell subordinates, who actually had devised the strategy of deploying Saddam Hussein's forces to maintain the necessary order in Iraq, but subject to constant harassment and undermining by U.S. imperialism. The sanctions were designed to decimate the population, to starve it out, and to put the regime in a position where it could in no way resist American dictate. But the regime itself was to be maintained, and it is this displacement of the regime and the decision on the part of a decaying capitalism that cannot afford the comprador regimes in Saudi Arabia and Egypt and Syria and Iran in Iraq itself, which has brought them to the pass of having to substitute U.S. occupation for a country selling government that they fund and manipulate as they have over the decades.
Well, let's look at what this means on the ground. New York Times, November 11th today. The Iraqi tribes asked to help GIs say they can't, an article by Susan Sachs writing from Fallujah. And she notes, since Baghdad fell in April, five different American commanders have tried to tame Fallujah, a rough-and-tumble city of 450,000 people that lived almost exclusively off the patronage of Mr. Hussein's government. Nearly every day, bombs explode near American convoys. Rocket-propelled grenades are fired at American patrols or soldiers. And this is when the soldiers are raiding the houses of suspected insurgents, writes Sachs. On November 2nd, a rocket fired from the outskirts of Fallujah brought down a Chinook helicopter, killing 16 soldiers on board. When you look at the main streets of Fallujah, she says, there are neatly written banners urging people to go against the Americans, and that the city hall where the American-appointed mayor sits is repeatedly hit with rocket-propelled grenades. In other words, despite the fact that there have been five different commanders. Now, why would there be five different U.S. commanders? Because not a single one has been able to pacify, in the terms of the Vietnam War, to destroy the people of Fallujah.
Well, it's more than that, Maya. As the article reveals, the U.S. has attempted to go to the tribal chieftains, as the Saddam Hussein regime had once done. But what the Saddam Hussein government had done with the tribal leaders was to distribute land and distribute food and distribute funds and to use the tribal chieftains as the transmission point for the population. None of that is going on now. And the tribal chieftain in Iraq's most rebellious city, Sheikh Khamis al-Assawi, who says, I have met more American commanders in the last 7 months than I can remember, states, every time a new general comes, they call us to a meeting and they say the same things. But what they don't understand is that we have no control over the people doing the attacks. Believe me, the people are not going to listen to me. And what the tribal leader has made clear, and what these articles are pointing out, is that this population is in a generalized state of resistance to occupation, a fight for liberation, a struggle against the foreign troops of a hated occupier. And nothing that tribal chiefs say will dissolve that sentiment in the population. And as the article states, the Iraqi tribes are asked to help the GIs. The chieftains say they cannot.
And what is it that the U.S. soldiers are doing? Kill, 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 basically, trigger happy. As you see in the Washington Post on November 10th, U.S.-appointed Iraqi council leader killed. In Baghdad, Iraqis marched in anger through the streets after the killing of an American-appointed local Iraqi council leader by U.S. military guards. Now, Mohammed Kadhi, who had been appointed to the council in Sadr City, where there are 2 million Shiites living in a very poor section of Baghdad, was fluent in English. Yes. And was a collaborator with the U.S. forces on the Iraqi council. And yet what the United States is saying to rationalize the outright murder of Mr. Kadhi is that he was in an altercation with the U.S. soldiers and that they were forced to shoot him.
As Newsday reported on, and the Associated Press carried the story yesterday from Fallujah, America's top general in the Middle East has warned community leaders in Iraq that the United States will use stern measures unless they curb attacks against U.S. forces. Colonel General Abizayed, chief of the U.S. Central Command, delivered a warning to the tribal sheikhs and mayors throughout the Sunni Triangle, throughout Baghdad, throughout the city of Ramadi, and Fallujah, according to the reports of Fallujah Mayor Taha Badawi. We have the capabilities and the equipment, Badawi quoted Abizayed as saying, to eliminate this resistance. The warning, the Associated Press reports, is another sign of a new Get Tough campaign against the insurgents. Hours after Abizaid's warning, the United States dropped 500-pound bombs throughout Fallujah. Now, for the JDAMs, or 500-pound bombs, create such waves of pressure over areas of two football fields that they literally suck and blow the organs out of all in their path. They decimate all flesh. They are weapons of utter destruction over vast areas, and they encompass the towns and the villages over which they are inflicted. Neither America nor the father of America scares us, said one resident. We Iraqis are striking at the Americans. They may retaliate by terrifying our children, but we will continue to resist. Fakhri Fayyad, a 60-year-old farmer, said, these reprisal attacks increase our hate and increase our spite. If you think you will scare us, you are wrong. Day after day, we will resist. You soldiers of the United States will be harmed, and attacks against them will increase.
Ralph, on the very same day as the JDAMs in Tikrit, Lieutenant Colonel Stephen Russell, commander of the 1st Battalion, 22nd Infantry Regiment, stated, after American troops backed by Bradley fighting vehicles swept through Iraqi neighborhoods before dawn, blasting houses with heavy machine guns and heavy weapons fire. And what was his remark after he imposed an 11 p.m. to 4 a.m. curfew? His remark was, quote, this is to remind the town that we have teeth and claws and we will use them. This is Lieutenant Colonel Stephen Russell. This is the United States forward march, forward advance. This is the way the United States creates democracy.
The United States detains relatives of suspects in Iraq attacks. Military takes hostages, reports the Washington Post. Khaldia, her eyes still heavy with sleep, 60-year-old Alpha Tahan awoke at 3 a.m. on a cool Saturday. Her husband was away working as a night watchman. Her daughter-in-law and mother-in-law were still in bed. The house cloaked in darkness, she bowed her head in prayer. Moments after, she whispered the first ritual words of faith. The U.S. soldiers charged through her front door. They pointed their guns. They were yelling at us in English. The soldiers were seeking her son, Thama 31. They detained her, another son, the other women, well over the other women who were detained included one who was well over 100 years old. Brown burlap bags were placed over their heads. Terrified and crying, they were driven in Humvees to the nearby U.S. base at Habania. The detention swept through the area of Khaldia. The hostages taken from family after family. The arrests of relatives, particularly women in Khaldia and in the villages of the Euphrates River Valley, are evocative, the article continues, of the tactics of the Israelis towards the Palestinians. Major John A. Nagel, Battalion Operations Commander of the 1st Infantry Division, said it is necessary to detain anyone, family members included, who has knowledge of any acts of nefarious people.
You are listening to Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoen
and Maya Schoen on WBAI 99.5 FM in New York and on the internet at www.wbai.org. This and our other programs are available on our internet site, www.takingaim.info, if you'd like to hear it again. Also, I'd like to remind you that we've just finished the WBAI Fall Fund Drive. Now is the time, if you didn't put your contribution to the station with a credit card, to please send in your checks, your money orders, so that we can fulfill and send out the premiums to you. Our program today is the Forward Advance of Freedom, the Forward Strategy of Freedom, the presentation of President George Bush. Ralph?
Destroying the people of Iraq, destroying the youth of the United States. Newsday, leveled trees sprout animosity. Dululia, November 5th, The bulldozers worked for 10 days and nights, methodically clearing out the date palms and the citrus groves as U.S. soldiers sealed the area. The people look on helplessly while jazz music blares from speakers mounted atop the soldiers' trucks and tanks and armored vehicles. U.S. commanders tell the farmers that there are insurgents who may be into thick orchards, and the ambushing soldiers drive along the road so trees are cut down. To the United States, clearing the fields is necessary to protect the troops' lives. To Iraqis, it is collective punishment. They told us that we are responsible for any attacks upon them, but we don't know who the attackers are, said Hussein Haraji, 71, the patriarch of an extended family that owns a portion of the uprooted fields. This is how the Americans want to help the Iraqi people. They destroy our land, they destroy our trees, they destroy our livelihood.
Ralph, also on October 31st, U.S. soldiers seal Saddam's home village, written by Slobodan Lekic, another AP reporter writing from Baghdad. American soldiers on Friday sealed off the village, that's Friday, October 31st, sealed off the village where Saddam Hussein was born and ordered adults to register for identity cards. Starting around midnight, U.S. soldiers, Iraqi police, and civil defense forces moved into Uja, a small dusty village about 10 miles southeast of Tikrit. Soldiers stretched concertina wire around the perimeter of the village and established checkpoints, that is, containing everyone. Residents over the age of 18 are required to have registration cards in order to move in and out of the village, the U.S. officers said. Now, doesn't this remind you of what the Israelis have done throughout the West Bank and Gaza? The United States, complete with putting hoods over people's heads, now requiring registration, collective punishment, and taking hostages. Ralph?
Al Jazeera reports exactly the same phenomenon in the village of Abu Ghraib. And the report states up to 1,000 civilians were protesting the occupation forces, the mass imprisonment of Iraqis, when fighting erupted near a marketplace. Iraqi civilians were killed. Iraqi policemen were also killed, and tanks were brought out and ran over a six-year-old child. Quote, the incident reminiscent of scenes of the Israeli occupation of Palestine as the child was killed under the tank's tracks as the tank moved relentlessly forward and crushed the young child. It is not clear how this fighting, which lasted over 7 hours, began. Bradley fighting vehicles, armored tanks, mechanized and airborne infantry joined in the assault upon the 1,000 civilians protesting the imprisonment of their family members. And indeed, the article in The Age by Sasa Kavik on November 10th, Tikrit, warplanes resumed the bombings in Iraq. U.S. warplanes bombed targets across Iraq, the first time since U.S. President George Bush declared that the major combat was over on May 1st. F-16 fighter bombers swooped, dropping bombs. Troops backed by armor and attack helicopters have destroyed houses that the U.S. military believes are used by insurgents. Dropping bombs on the landscape as a pure demonstration of power is an unusual tactic, underscoring the military's fury at the downing of helicopters. The Red Cross announced a temporary closure of its Baghdad and Basra offices as the bombings increased and spread across the country.
USA Today, Ralph, also reported on Operation Ivy Cyclone, which is the name of this bombing operation. And Major Jocelyn Aberley, the spokeswoman for the Army's 4th Infantry Division, stated clearly, quote, if necessary, we'll carry out more shows of force. More shows of force. Gunship battles, JDAMs, collective punishment, hostages. And yet, there is still other facets to the U.S. occupation, and one that was investigated by Greenpeace International last June, which was the deadly waste of radioactive contamination, the uranium yellow cake that had been left out for villages. The U.S. Army didn't protect these areas where there was radioactive contamination, and thus the villagers, when they took the containers containing the yellow cake and the empty containers to use to make cooking utensils and other uses for containing water, for instance, in these barrels, they are now subject to radioactive poisoning. This is published by Greenpeace International. It's available on the Greenpeace website. It's a report from the 24th of June, Deadly Waste Returned. And they say particularly that Greenpeace itself returned a huge canister the size of a small car. It contains significant quantities of radioactive yellow cake that have been dumped on a busy section of open ground near the Tuefa plant. Despite the military being aware, that's the U.S. military, being aware of its presence, it had been left open and unattended for more than 20 days. Radiation experts have examined it, and they also examined the villagers there who used the material for house building, water, and food storage. Radioactive activity in the houses were 10,000 times above normal. 900 pupil primary school had radioactivity of 3,000 times normal. And this is going on throughout Iraq. Ralph?
It is an echo, of course, of the use throughout Iraq of depleted uranium in every shell, every bullet, every cruise and Tomahawk missile, which has created a generalized condition of birth deformities, and that has impacted, of course, the U.S. soldiers as well, which we will come to in one
minute. Well, Ralph, it's interesting you mention that, because Sarah Flounders of the IAC had done a report that was published in the Coastal Post of Marin County in September, and she refers to a Seattle Post-Intelligencer article from August 4th that measured radiation levels at six sites from Basra to Baghdad, and they were 15,000 times the normal background radiation levels. The Pentagon, according to the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, and the United Nations estimate that the U.S. and Britain used 1,100 to 2,200 tons of armor-piercing shells made of depleted uranium during the attacks on Iraq in March and April, far more than the 375 tons used in the 1991 Gulf War. What this means is going to be long-term damage, long-term suffering for both the Iraqi people and the U.S. troops stationed in Iraq, 130,000 U.S. troops. Radiation readings were hottest in Iraq, 1,900 times, which is normal background radiation levels. And spent shell casing are still littering the ground. We can expect over the years long-term effects of cancer, chronic fatigue syndrome, joint and muscle pain, rashes, neurological, nerve damage, infections, lung and kidney damage, vision problems, autoimmune deficiencies, severe skin conditions, and increases in miscarriages, maternal mortality, genetic birth defects, as we have documented in program after program on Taking Aim over the past 2 years.
Well, the consequences for U.S. soldiers is overwhelming and is now reflected in almost every veterans organization's website and information service. The 600,000 to 700,000 U.S. soldiers that were involved in the first Gulf War, over 200,000 of them are affected by the consequences of depleted uranium and the forced anthrax and other biological agent nominal vaccines imposed upon them.
Speaking of veterans, an article you found in Neurology from September of this year showed that Lou Gehrig's disease appears three times more often in the Gulf War veterans than in the rest of the population. Ralph?
It's not only, yes, my ALS, or the Lou Gehrig's disease, and generalized neurological dysfunction is now epidemic, and it's already taking its toll amongst the U.S. soldiers who are currently in Iraq. I want to mention as well, Maya, that we began this description of the reality on the ground in Iraq with citations from Milt Bearden and his journalistic counterpart in David Reif. Insofar as there's a wing of the class that is taking heed of the consequences of this barbarous war and the generalized resistance it is meeting. Leon Hadar, a research fellow in foreign policy studies at the Cato Institute, the conservative institute, and the author of Quagmire, America in the Middle East, he elucidates as well the understanding of that wing of capital that prefers to rule with intermediates under their control, the consequences of the persistence of this occupation. But listen to what they propose. They propose the following alternatives. The installation of an authoritarian leader who will maintain a unified Iraq by centralizing power in Baghdad, or the division of Iraq into three separate Kosovo-like mini-states under international safeguards, an American Turkish protectorate in the Kurdish north, a European Arab military presence in the Sunni areas, and a UN authority in the Shiite parts. Only by transforming the current Pax Americana, by allowing America's allies a chance to sit in the post driver's seat, will we be able to persuade France, Germany, Russia, and India to share in the stabilizing of Iraq, a working strategy that reduces the burden of occupying Iraq and will extricate the United States from that country, will be welcomed by American voters. In short, the Democratic Party alternative to the Bush regime, or that wing of the rulers that seeks now to extricate itself, has a formula, all right, fragmenting the country and seeking co-imperial occupation as the futile alternative. And here is a measure of where they are going with this. In The Guardian and in the Baluchistan Post, 11-10, November 10th, U.S. deploys more troops on Afghan-Pakistani borders. Over special forces and special units of the United States military are now in the tribal areas of Afghanistan and Pakistan, and they are being resisted by the tribes there, who see them not only as occupiers, but as responsible for disseminating toxins throughout the region. As described in The Guardian and in the Baluchistan Post, this affects over 8 million people, largely of the Pashtun nationality, and it touches upon the future of 27 million Pashtuns who are living in both Pakistan and Afghanistan and have long aspired to an independent Baluchistan and Pashtunistan. What the United States Special Forces, with their raids and predations, are doing is inspiring a generalized resistance, not just in Afghanistan as such, but now in Pakistan and in the border areas themselves. What we are witnessing here is what Che Guevara once described. Two, three, or more Vietnams, he once counseled, spread imperialism thin. The crisis of capitalism is such that they are doing this job for us. They are arousing in people the necessity to struggle, to resist, and all power to that resistance wherever an occupation is present, wherever the U.S. imperial reach is felt. It is ongoing as we speak.
And Ralph, in order to spread themselves across the world, the United States, as you are noting, respects no borders. And a few days ago, it was announced in the press that Task Force 121 was being established by U.S. Central Command Chief General John Abizide to hunt high-value targets. Now, this is a new covert commando force. Covert commando force, Task Force 121, that will not be restricted, according to the Pentagon, to borders of Iraq, Afghanistan, and other places. It is composed of special operations forces from the Army, the Navy, and the Air Force, and it is supplemented by a large conventional force to secure perimeters, create diversion, or supply greater firepower than that available to Task Force 121. Now, this special covert force involving the Air Force, the Army, the Marines, all these special operations groups, is in addition to the Central Intelligence Agency's own paramilitary forces, which act even swifter.
And yet, what they're, the response of the rulers to this calamity that they have generated and that they are now confronting in Iraq and in Afghanistan and soon to be in Pakistan, they want to up the ante and extend it to Syria, Iran, and yes, Saudi Arabia. For note the fact that the United States Embassy had a weak warning of the putative attacks in Riyadh. And indeed, Senator Porter and the congressman who had held hearings on this noted that they had advanced notice of attacks pending in Saudi Arabia. And that, as with the Vinal attack, these attackers were wearing the security uniforms of the special forces of the Saudi regime
and,
itself.
And also the car they were driving was the same type that the police in Saudi Arabia use.
The Woolsey, Pearl, Wolfowitz, and now Bush, in his recent speech, siren to replace the regime in Saudi Arabia, comes with the mantra, protect the oil. And it's most instructive that in the lead editorial of the New York Times today, they sound the alarm that what they call one quarter of the world's oil reserves in Saudi Arabia cannot be permitted to fall under the control of Al-Qaeda. And what is the forward plan of the imperial rulers for Saudi Arabia? They are going to sector off the east of Saudi Arabia and direct it to military occupation as they destabilize the Saudi regime itself, setting up the Saudis and taking out the Saudis. And what are the consequences for U.S. soldiers of these mad adventures of a desperate imperialism? Congressional delegation stops to visit patients at Landstuhl, Germany. Six U.S. congressmen visiting Iraq to study small business opportunities got a close-up look at the danger U.S. soldiers are facing. The delegation of four Republicans and two Democrats happened to be midair on a C-130 transport plane over Iraq when word of the deadly Chinook crash came to the pilots in the pilots in the cockpit. And consequently, the delegation made a stop, unexpected, at the military hospital in Landstuhl, where they discovered that one hospital in Germany has treated, quote, over 7,000 injured servicemen from the Iraq War, over 7,000 injured U.S. soldiers in one hospital in Germany. The official statistics are 1,700 injured, 7,000 in one hospital alone. The congressman met with injured soldiers, arms amputated by rocket-propelled grenades, others injured. They are basically on life support. And the Stars and Stripes, which carries this article on November 11th, amplifies it with a description of the Ramstein medical facility at the Ramstein Air Base in Germany, which is undergoing a major expansion to build a semi-permanent home for the contingency medical ward for the continuing and growing numbers of U.S. soldiers maimed in the occupation of Iraq.
Well, the Washington Post noted as early as September that the number of wounded in action is on the rise, and at that time it was 10 American troops a day being officially declared, quote, wounded in action, and now the numbers are much higher. And if you look at Walter Reed Hospital, which is the premier Army hospital, and you look at Walter Reed is becoming, it is becoming a place where amputation after amputation is being carried out. As Major General Kevin C. Kiley, the hospital's commanding general, stated that rocket-propelled grenades and mines cause multiple wound multiple troops at a time and cause, quote, the kind of amputating damage that you don't necessarily see with a bullet wound to the arm or the leg. Now, I have to recall in Lebanon, where this was the cluster bomb results, and seeing young children in the hospitals where they were, the doctors were forced to amputate because of the shrapnel wounds. They were just, legs, their arms, they were just shredded. And this is what you're seeing now with the U.S. soldiers, too. So what happens, though, is that Walter Reed, which is a premier hospital, the soldiers are getting the highest level of treatment. But that is not the case with soldiers in other places throughout the country. Ralph?
Vets abandoned, the San Francisco Examiner, December 28th. For 11 years, more than 100,000 Gulf War vets complaining of syndromes characterized by chronic fatigue, headaches, joint pains, memory loss, cancer, and birth defects. For 11 years, the Department of Defense has known the cause, but systematically denied. The study is hardly a bolt from the blue. And now that article in the San Francisco Examiner is supplemented by the reports of the current moment in the Wall Street Journal. Indeed, a major article in the Wall Street Journal describes how the U.S. soldiers are experiencing all of those symptoms in plenitude and are being shunted aside and ignored. Vets for Common Sense. U.S. Senator Bond demands investigation into Fort Knox and Fort Stewart scandals. We've got to do something about this. We have to move these veterans into clinics and establish minimum standards for these soldiers. Over 600 injured soldiers have been waiting weeks and months for doctors at Fort Stewart in squalid cement barracks with no air conditioning or running water. UPI reports that over 400 of these injured soldiers face long waits for care at Fort Knox. Now after Fort Stewart, Fort Knox and Fort Campbell, Fort Lewis as well has acknowledged that there are no doctors and no medical treatment for the seriously injured veterans. The sick and injured, RIP Army Care, Associated Press, October 20th. He spent the past 2 months living in Spartan concrete barracks, where his treatment has amounted to one doctor's appointment and a visit to a physician's assistant. The medical care here is substandard by any criterion. The sick and the injured have long waits for health care, uncomfortable housing, and indeed, in Fort Stewart, it is acknowledged that 633 National Guard and Army Reserve troops are on medical hold for treatment of their injuries. The citizens, the soldiers, are without hospitalization, without medical attention, without proper food, without proper housing, which ignores soldiers' burials, reports the Associated Press on October 30th. Three more U.S. servicemen killed in combat. In the coming days, their bodies will be boxed up and sent home for burial. While en route, the coffins will be deliberately shielded from view, lest the media capture on film the dark image of the ultimate sacrifice. Hundreds of U.S. troops killed in this war are interred and memorialized without the presence of the President of the United States or anyone on behalf of the government. Increasingly, the article continues, the proclivity on the part of Bush to avoid the normal duty of a commander-in-chief to honor dead soldiers is causing rising rage among veterans and their families who have noticed what appears to be a historically anomalous sight.
Ralph, the New York Post on October 5th had an exclusive about AWOL. The GI Rights Hotline, a national soldier support service, has logged a 75% increase in calls in the last 12 weeks, with more than 100 of those calls from soldiers or people on their behalf asking about the penalties associated with going AWOL, absent without leave. The military is aware of how low troop morale is, says Teresa Panapinto, who's the program coordinator of the GI Rights Hotline. And now they have a service that dates back to the Korean War. Quote, she says the military is concerned that people are going to come home and not go back.
In a tent hospital, a close-up view of the attacks in Iraq, the Wall Street Journal on October 29th. As the chopper blades churned up sand and dust near the field hospital, the ambulance driver unloads stretchers carrying the severely injured. Sergeant Chuck Bartels. Clearly, still clear-headed despite his injuries, his face bloody and swollen, his arms a mess of torn flesh. But the hospital treatment and the emergency treatment is not available for these veterans, as the article describes. And article after article cites in military base after military base, the complete abandonment of the injured and wounded from the war in Iraq. We shall deal with the reaction of the families of the military soldiers and the disaffection of the population at large from this abandonment of the grunts, the cannon fodder for the imperial wars, when we return to Taking Aim next week.
You've been listening to Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our internet site again is www.takingaim.info. You can contact us by email at takingaim@wbai.org or call us at 212-209-2953 or 707-552-9995. You can also write to us at P.O. Box 6345, Vallejo, California, 94591. We'll be with you next week.